the metro area.
Folks, we'll call a meeting to order. We've got two relatively brief individual bills, and then we're going to have a discussion of STOLI, an insurance-related matter for informational purposes. The chair will move House File 3789, be recommended pass and refer to the House floor. Representative Gardner, if you can walk us through your bill briefly, we'd appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I hope all these people aren't here for me.
Indeed they are, actually. They've all...
I was a student in the Soviet Union, Mr. Chair, 20 years ago. The word STOLI stood for something else.
No, that's exactly what we intend to talk about, is the vodka. So, all right, Representative Gardner, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zellers correctly asked that this bill be referred to Commerce on the issue of retail signage. That was sort of the path that took in the Senate, and no harm, no foul. This is a bill that Senator Roebling and I are coordinating on. There is a law that requires or that bans the use of phosphorus and lawn fertilizer in the state except for four exceptions. So it is still possible to buy phosphorus-laden fertilizer at a retailer in Minnesota. The Agricultural Department did do a study. You have the executive summary there in your packet, which indicates that the law has been fairly successful in reducing the amount of fertilizer use that has phosphorus in Minnesota. However, you can still more or less buy phosphorus-laden fertilizer in the state and not really know whether the law applies to you or not, because you may not be aware of it. With the help of Department of Ag, we developed a sign which we're just asking be posted in retailers in the 7-county metro. That was the bill as amended, which would just say you can only use phosphorus-laden fertilizer for these four uses. It's something that the Department of Ag has as a PDF file, which is easily downloadable and printable, and you can use some Scotch tape made right here in Minnesota, I hope, and tape it right to the wall or the pallet right by that fertilizer. There are no penalties in the bill, and Mr. Chair, that's it in a nutshell.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. Is there anyone else who desires to testify with respect to House File 3789?
I beg your pardon, Mr. Chair. I was going to mention the repealer, which just repeals the report requirement, since the report has already been completed, and we're just taking that requirement out of the bill to clean up the statute.
Fair enough. Good point. Anyone else who desires to testify? Are there questions or comments? Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Gardner, why is this good for the 7-county metro area if not for the state?
Representative Gardner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney and the Ag Policy Committee, I think this is deemed to possibly be a vehicle for something else, and that if it's just an issue about people in their suburban lawns to be worried about, that we should limit to the 7-county metro. The Senate version, as well as the original House version, did say statewide.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, and don't people in St. Cloud or Wilmer or Worthington or Rochester make lawns?
Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I assume that they do.
Representative Mahoney, anything further? I think you're preaching to the converted, I suspect, at the table there.
Well, I guess maybe I am, but I just have never been able to understand why it's okay to use phosphorus in 95% of the state, but not in 5% of the state. But maybe this is a house floor kind of amendment. Just leave it there, and we've got other things to address today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Are there others? Representative Simpson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Mahoney. I think if you look at this indicator, it is statewide. The use of phosphorus-free fertilizer is already statewide. And I think the whole idea of having a sign is really a waste of paper and a waste of time. I happen to own a retail facility, and I have to put up signs all the time, and people do not pay any attention to them. And all this is busy work here and busy work for the retailers, and it means nothing. People need to be educated on the use of fertilizers, and I think they're doing a good job of doing that. If you look at the percentage of the fertilizers that are being used today compared to what I said in 2002 or whatever it is, the trend is we're educating people fines aren't going to do anything.
Any other one? Any other members that desire to be heard? Any other comments or testimony? Representative Gardner, any final comments?
No, Mr. Chair. Enjoy the rest of the day.
Thank you. The Chair will renew House motion that House File 3789 be recommended pass and refer to the House floor. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed?
No.
The motion carries. Thank you, Representative Gardner. Next up is Representative McFarland, House File 2471. Representative Zellers, it's my understanding you wish to move this to the House floor. Is that correct?
That's true, Mr. Chairman. I'll move House File 2471 pass and be referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Representative Zellers. Representative McFarland, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to have this bill heard today. This file was introduced last spring. What I had done originally was gone to the Attorney General's office to get an opinion on it. There were some details that needed to be worked out, and today that all came together. And the Attorney General's office has looked at the language. If you will look, there's an author's amendment that you have.
Thank you, Representative McFarland. Representative Zellers, it's the A101 amendment. I just had Representative Pender, I'm sorry to demote you, Tom, but Mr. Pender reviewed it, said it looked fine. Do you desire to move that, put it in the shape the author desires to move it?
I will, Mr. Chairman.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative McFarland.
I'd like to give a little background on this. This started out with my own local food shelf, but I think it benefits food shelves throughout the state of Minnesota. Our food shelf has done a very good job of getting donations, especially of canned goods and things like that. And what had happened was they were so good at doing it that it brought them, when they valued them for an asset, they came over the $350,000 asset level and had to file the larger financial accounting forms, which cost them $3,000 to $4,000 more a year. And they felt that they'd rather put that money towards food. And so we were looking for a way to change that. And I have two people here as witnesses. I have Mark Sather, the city manager of White Bear Lake, and I also have Colleen Moriarty from Hunger Solutions here to speak to this.
Thank you, Representative McFarland. Who wants to go first?
I'll go first.
All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Colleen Moriarty. I'm the executive director of Hunger Solutions Minnesota. We represent over 300 food shelves and the 6 America Second Harvest Food Bank and other emergency meal programs within the state of Minnesota. Frankly, everything we can do to make sure that there are more resources available for the people in our state who need it the most is what we support and what we are working on a daily basis for. We've seen dramatic increases in hunger since 2000, almost a 62% increase in the use of food shelves. There are 2 million visits to food shelves every year in the state of Minnesota. 50% of those are families with children, and nearly 80% of those are working families. These are our neighbors. These are the people in our community that have very little room to move in the family budget. Transportation's going up. Health care is going up. Their wages are probably staying the same. If they've lost their job, they've been reemployed at perhaps a lower rate, and they really have done their best to cobble together a family budget that's realistic, but the one thing that they're not being able to afford in increasing numbers in the state of Minnesota is food. And so this kind of innovative thinking on Representative McFarland's part really represents the fact that we want to do everything we can with every penny that comes into our nonprofits and our local food shelves, where volunteerism and this kind of spirit makes up the backbone of the kind of generosity that represents poor people in our state. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Moriarty. Mr. Sather.
Mr. Chair, as Representative McFarland said, my name is Mark Sather, and I'm here as city manager of White Bear Lake is my actual position, but as a member of the White Bear Area Food Shelf Board. I'm appointed by the mayor to serve in that capacity. But we have 15 members on that board, and they're representative of various places of worship and a number of civic organizations and volunteers in our community. We represent 10 different cities within our service area and serve, unfortunately, far too many families and individuals. I believe over 17,000 meals were served last year through our food shelf.
All of that money comes from private contributions and fundraisers. And unfortunately, we've gone over a threshold of $350,000, which has increased the requirement from our annual computation and report that's produced by a local CPA firm to one that requires much more significant auditing and reporting. Our food shelf board meets at least quarterly, sometimes more often as needed for some of the fundraising and actual service projects. And we have a member, under our bylaws, we have a person who is an accountant who provides regular monthly reports to our board. So there's strict accounting. We know where the money is. We know where the food is. Part of our problem is the practice is we put a value on the food based on the recommendation of the auditor, and more than half of our donations are in the form of food. So that puts us over the $350,000, which costs us in the area of $3,800 to $4,000 additional cost per year. And I know because I personally asked a lot of people for donations, and they believe that the volunteers on our food shelf board are making sure that that money goes to hungry individuals. And we would just as soon try to lower our overhead costs by doing this, and we've given it careful consideration by our board and don't believe that it puts the good of the food shelf at risk. We have a good check and balance system, and simply by taking this amendment, we would take the food which is donated not for resale but to be given to families in need, and not include that in the calculation of $350,000. Ask for your consideration.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Pater. Representative McFarland, anything further?
Any questions?
I don't see any. Is there anyone else that desires to testify with respect to House File 2471? If not,
I hope that you'll pass this. I think it's a great way. It saves money. It doesn't cost anything to anybody, but it puts more money into our food shelf. So I hope you'll support it.
Thank you, Representative McFarland,
Ms.
Moriarty, and Mr. Sather. This is actually one of those common sense, innovative pieces of legislation that happens every once in a while around here and makes people's lives a little bit better. So, Representative McFarland, I commend you on bringing it forward. With that, Representative Zellers will renew his motion that House File 2471 be recommended to pass as amended and referred to the House floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman,
I was
wondering, before we get on to the solely discussion, I'd like to move to reconsider House File 863, the Clean Car Initiative. I really don't think we had enough discussion on that bill, and as I understand it, has not passed another committee yet, so technically it's still in our possession.
We should send one of our special assistants to find Representative Portman.
Okay.
And get her down here right away.
Okay. Do you want to go solely first, and then we can
make
the motion?
I think we should probably do that first. Okay. And then, if somebody could go and grab Representative Hordman, that would be helpful.
Okay. Chairman,
the next topic on our agenda is the discussion of stranger-originated life insurance and life settlement industry. Professor Pender is going to walk us through kind of an overview of STOLI and the life settlement industry in Minnesota. Before we do that, Representative Burns moves the minutes of the March 19, 2008 committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Thank you, Representative Burns. I think that probably gets you some points in the fantasy legislature thing on NPR. I don't know, but we'll check. Mr. Pender, welcome to the committee, your committee. If you'd be kind enough to kind of walk us through this topic. The reason, by the way, before we get underway, there were two bills. We're not specifically addressing those two bills that were introduced with respect to this topic. My understanding, my hope, is that the various interested parties will be able to figure out this topic, and maybe there is some common ground in the interim. I'm relatively confident that we will not see a bill emerge yet this session, but it is one that I expected members would probably be hearing about in a considerable volume and frequency over the summer and fall. And so what I wanted to do was give our members kind of an overview of what can be a fairly complex topic in preparation for that those visits that they may get over the summer and fall. To that end, rather than take up the two individual bills, I thought it best that perhaps we should give Mr. Pender, who serves as our nonpartisan staff and is very highly trusted and has the utmost of integrity among members of this committee. To kind of walk us through that, and then we want to hear from the department that would undoubtedly be charged with enforcement if there is a bill, and then finally we want to hear from everybody that that has a say in this, and we've got a nice list of people that are desirous of talking with us this afternoon. All that said, I also want to, and I will assure our members that we will be out of here no later than 5:15, which is a little bit earlier than we normally are. But I know that people have a lot of commitments, especially this deep into session. So that's when we're going to be finished up. And with that, Mr. Pender, if you can kind of walk us through the topic, we'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair and members, I was asked to give about a 5 or 10 minute introduction to the subject of STOLE. And I don't claim to be an expert on it until about a year and a half or 2 years ago. I was blissfully ignorant of the concept and the controversy. Stranger originated life insurance, and I have a handout here, and I'm going to be kind of following that handout. Stranger originated life insurance, or STOLE, and I sometimes see it called stranger owned instead of stranger originated life insurance, is and this is just sort of my definition. I didn't copy this from anywhere. Is life insurance issued on the life of an individual as part of a transaction in which that individual agrees to transfer ownership of the life insurance policy to someone who is a stranger to the individual whose life is insured? And it might help to kind of get our hands around this subject to think about the three different entities that are involved in a life insurance policy. There's the owner of the life insurance policy. There's the person whose life is insured under that policy, and those two people need not be the same. And then there's the beneficiary of the policy, the person who the owner has the right to designate as the person who will get the death benefit when the person whose life is insured dies. So there are those three entities. Basically, if you're the owner of the policy, you get to name the beneficiary. So when a life insurance policy is sold, it's the ownership that's sold, and the owner, the new owner then has the right to name the beneficiary and can name him or herself as the beneficiary. And the person whose life is insured doesn't change as a result of that transaction. STOLE differs from other what are called life settlements, in which a person sells a policy on the person's life. And I'll just cover two examples of that. One is what are called viatical settlements, which are regulated under Minnesota law, under legislation passed in 1995. The word viatical comes from the word viaticum, which is a religious term for communion given to a person whose life is about to end, a person who's on his or her deathbed, I guess. What that basically arose out of was the AIDS epidemic of the 80s and early 90s, in which people were dying relatively early in their life. Some of them had life insurance policies. Many of them didn't have dependents that they wanted to get the benefits of the policy, and basically they wanted to sell the policies to provide money for their medical care. And so at that time it was felt like a good idea to regulate these kind of transactions. And so we do have laws that regulate the sale of policies, and it's limited to people who are in that category, people who are have a chronic condition that's likely to result in death relatively soon. And the sale of a policy, obviously, I mean, the policy has some value, and it's a better thing for the owner of the policy to be able to sell it rather than just, you know, stop paying the premiums and allow it to lapse. So it's a situation where it's beneficial to sell the policy. Another kind of thing that's not Stoley is simply the sale of a policy that the insured took out sometime earlier in life with no intention of, at that time, of selling it. And the market for these kind of things is generally for people who are age 70 or older. And I got a call from Constituent Services just a couple of weeks ago where they'd gotten an inquiry from an elderly man who was in his late 80s, I think, who was upset that his premiums had gone up, and he'd had this policy for many, many years, and it seemed like a lot to be paying, and he was thinking of just letting the policy lapse after paying his premiums all those years. And you know, I told the Constituent Services person, it seems to me that for a person of his age, that premium he was paying each year, even though it seemed quite high, it was a good investment in exchange for the $30,000 that he'd get given his life expectancy. I don't know if the member had the courage to tell him that, but that's the situation he was in, at least as I looked at it. There's a developing market, financial market, for policies obtained through life settlements, where the policy is sold. And the investment banking industry views them as investments that can be packaged as a security. So it's sort of like mortgages are being packaged or have been packaged as securities. So you take about 200 life insurance policies and you put them in a package, and then you sell shares of that package. And obviously your share is going to be a good investment or not, depending upon how many people die, how soon, that are in that that are in that package. And these policies, these securities are sold to hedge funds, pension funds, and other investors. There is really a new form of asset-backed security, since it's a security backed by these assets, namely life insurance policies that insure the lives of people who are ultimately going to die. And they're often called death bonds. One attraction of investing in life insurance policies is that the returns on them are not correlated with the returns on other financial assets. So it's like the ultimate in diversification. Because you can buy an asset that's not, you know, it's not correlated with the stock market, it's not correlated with the bond market, it's correlated, you know, it's just based on death, basically. And that's you know, one of the things in life that's certain, I guess. I'm going to just touch briefly on the legal concept of insurable interest, which is an issue in this general subject. And the concept of insurable interest was created in an act of the English Parliament in 1746. And basically what it requires is that at least at the time a life insurance policy is issued, that the owner of it would suffer financial loss upon the death of the person whose life the policy insures. And so, and there are a lot of exceptions to this, and a lot of details involving it and so on, but that's the basic concept. And the reason, the rationale for the concept of insurable interest is that, if you're just investing in a policy that insures someone else, and you don't either benefit or harm by that person's death, except if you own the policy, you're gambling. I mean, that's one concept. But it's sort of like the opposite of insurance. Insurance is reducing risk, and if you're buying an asset like this, you're arguably engaged in gambling. And the other rationale for the insurable interest requirement is that if you know the person whose life is insured by a policy you own, and you know where they live, you may have an incentive to have that policy mature earlier than it might otherwise do. And I heard a few years ago that the concept of selling life insurance policies has been very common in France for a number of years, and often the owner of the policy and the person whose life is insured know who each other are, and they exchange Christmas cards. And I guess if you're If you're the owner of the policy, you send your Christmas card, and maybe you kind of hope you don't get one back that year. It means the person died or is near death. This concept of insurable interest, which is obviously involved in STOLE one way or another, is not in Minnesota statutes, but like a lot of other legal principles that are binding in Minnesota, it's in the common law that we inherited from England. And Minnesota statutes do refer to it in that we have two sections that provide exceptions. One is for a life insurance policy that a person transfers to a charity that doesn't have an insurable interest in that person's life. And the other one is for employee benefit plans that often insure the lives of people who are covered by the employee benefit plan. So that's my introductory overview of the concept, and I'll look forward to hearing from all the people in the room who know a lot more about it than I do.
Thank you, Mr. Penner. Mr. Penner will be coming up at the conclusion for the balance of his testimony, which will be in the neighborhood of about an hour to an hour and a half. Next up is
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Zeller.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. You know, I guess I will have to withdraw my motion to reconsider House File 863. I just thought that such foolhardy legislation belonged on the fool's day. So although it's maybe a good idea to rethink it, I guess we'll leave it on its way to a quick California death.
Thank you, Representative Zeller. We should probably have those folks remain in the room, though, don't you think, just in case you reconsider your motion to reconsider.
Well,
most of them came out of breath, I might add, from all corners of the... We've got Mr. Hyland and Ms. Naren, we've got Ms. Emerson, who all came running. Representative Hartman was out in the hallway.
Well, you know, as the majority leader said, Mr. Chairman, the situation is fluid. I mean, as the committee continues on, we technically are still in session. The committee is still in...
One never knows.
Got a forum here. And,
Representative Mahoney.
I'm just wondering, do you think there's an insurance agent that I could buy some life insurance on Zeller?
Not at all.
Well, I figure after today, you must not make it back to
the That's
building.
Not a bad idea. the likelihood of you making it out. But with that, we have, I believe, Commissioner Wilson is with us as well and has a few comments regarding the topic. I think someone was just purchased on you, Representative Zeller. So.
Almost like a
warrior. There's no one else.
Commissioner, welcome to the committee. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and I appreciate Mr. Pender's introduction to this important subject. I don't want my comments to be interpreted as entirely negative, but it is, since there's no bill for us to consider at this time. It's mostly the concerns that we would have in our department in the effort to make sure that we protect the consumers of the state, and particularly of the life insurance in this case. I think that we're all somewhat, and I certainly am, a reflection of my life experiences. And I want to indulge your time just briefly, if I could, on some of those experiences, because one of the things that I think that this could do is destabilize the insurance industry and the insurance market. In 1975, and I'll go through this pretty darn quick, but in 1975, I got in the home building business, developing housing for affordable and low income. The FHA and the state housing bonds were bought by insurance companies. Built a shopping center. It was financed, and the farms that surrounded the area were financed by the insurance industry. And I could go on and on, but later when we developed an office site, it was occupied by Principal Financial, and they have become the largest employer in the community, very stable. Nevertheless, when looking at development in real estate throughout my career, whether it was homes or business or farms, they were either financed through collateralized mortgage in the home building industry, or in farms and business more directly. So one of my concerns is when I see something that's significantly different about an industry, I'm old enough to say, wait a minute, let's take a hard look at it. I personally have witnessed the development of the collateralized mortgage obligation, which I thought in 1985 when it was being developed and I was engaged in the use of that form of financing for 20 years, thought it brought to this nation the longest term, the lowest interest rates of anywhere in the world. And that's pretty much reflected also in the area of long-term financing for business and farms. One of the things that concerns me the most here is if you look at the finance on Wall Street today and how badly it's gotten muddled up, the one stable, well-developed, historically developed part of our economy is the insurance business. They're long-term investors, and we can count on their investors and support through every community in the state. I could go on, but that sets the table for some of my concern is how this could destabilize. The other thing is when we look at what the purpose of insurance is in the first place, when we get married and have a family, you're insuring yourself for against the loss of your life in behalf of your family. Later on, it may be to educate the kids in case of the loss of principal income earner. If you start a business, as I did, and you go out and you sign notes to get the business going in excess of your ability to pay, and with recourse, you bring out life insurance to cover that event. It's not only life insurance, but very often as you get older, you do as I did and convert that to other forms of investment for estate purposes. Our government has seen that the over the years, this investment so important that it's tax-free, so that many people don't understand that in estate planning, business planning, the cheapest way to cover the event of an untimely death, or in the case of an estate, cover the tax due to allow the estate to be passed without tax. There are other issues that concern our department, Mr. Chairman, but not the least of which, frankly, I brought our actuary along in case there's questions. I understand now that maybe there's a different format, but one of our greatest concerns here is that if we change the format that's laid out historically for this product, it's going to significantly change the pricing. And as I go through the life experiences of marriage, protection, education, and business, and estate planning, and other forms, I have to believe that at the time, at least for me, that I was in need of those benefits, that cost was important. And for us to take and transform this product into something that was never intended to be, certainly was going to raise the cost, and that's a great concern to our department. Mr. Chairman, that pretty well concludes. I just don't see us destabilizing a very stable without great concern.
Very good. Thank you, Commissioner. Appreciate your comments. I think what we will try to do is get through the testimony of the various folks. And, Commissioner, I don't mean to impose further on your time. I'm sorry, sir. You are the actuary.
I'm one of the actuaries, yes.
If you could remain, and I think Mr. Sexton is probably around as well, if you guys could remain till the end of the discussion so that if we have questions, maybe we can ask those folks from your department. We also, if you got some time, if you could calculate the likelihood of Mr. Representative Zeller's making it out alive after that motion to reconsider.
Mr. Chairman, I had about 90 minutes worth of remarks, but I'll resume those. We'll start those at 5:15.
Thank you. Commissioner, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with that, I think we'll work our way down the list. Both sides have promised me that they've got about 12 minutes worth of comments in total, which means that we should be done no later than 5:11. We'll find out how close folks really are. But Mr. Spizzetto, welcome back.
Grazie, Signor Erkins. Mi chiamo Domenico Spizzetto. Sono l'avvocato per NEFA Minnesota. ecco qui presentare nostra posizione rigotto soli.
Soli e male.
Just so you know, what I told Mr. Spazzetto at the outset is whether he spoke Italian or English, it would all be the same to us. So,
Mr. Chairman,
as long as he could make that gesture, I think we understood.
Mr. Chairman, I do have some remarks in English that I'd like to present.
Fair enough.
I'm Dominic Spazzetto. I'm here representing the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, the Minnesota chapter. And I'm here to speak in opposition to STOLI and in support of legislation that restricts and prohibits that practice in Minnesota. There's been a lure of easy money, and investors have flocked to the secondary life insurance market. And frankly, I didn't even know there was a secondary life insurance market until a couple of years ago. And, of course, the fall of the secondary mortgage market, the subprime market, has created a sort of a minor gold rush, if you will, into this type of an investment. First of all, Mr. Pender indicated that we do have life settlement legislation or viatical settlement legislation that we passed back in the early 80s to deal with the AIDS epidemic. And because of the advances made in medication and treatment of that disease, it's no longer a prevalent type of situation. So now that market has shifted to seniors, again, as Mr. Pender said, we're looking at those 65 or 70 years old with a life expectancy of maybe 2 to 10 years. And this sort of attempt to distort the purpose of life insurance and also change what we consider to be the insurable interest law, which I didn't really know went back to common law, but thank you for giving me that information, has been the tenet of what we have sold life insurance in this country for many years, to protect families and businesses in the premature death of loved ones or breadwinners or key employees. And because of that, we've gotten tax-advantaged treatment of life insurance proceeds, which we think are very important. STOLI is an attempt to get around the doctrine of life insurance, and it creates problems for the industry, agents, and policyholders. For policyholders and those seniors that are looking at insurance, it's going to increase the cost of insurance for seniors. And we've already seen this as a result of STOLI, where seniors' premiums have risen while younger policyholders' premiums have actually been reduced. There are going to be additional forms and questions to determine if the senior is actually seeking a policy for the benefit of their beneficiaries or if there is an insurable interest, or if it is part of this sort of shell game to set up an investor benefit type of program. And there will be tax consequences for those seniors to participate in this particular product, and they take the proceeds or the purchase, the life settlement or whatever we're going to call it, that is taxable, and in many cases they're not aware of that and it creates problems for that. Plus, it could inhibit their ability to get insurance in the future. If insurance companies know that this has occurred, they'll be less likely to provide insurance to those persons. It creates problems for insurance producers. Some STOLI transactions are actually based on incorrect answers or even fraud on the life insurance application, where truth could lead to the rejection of the policy. There are ways to hide the fact that this policy is being purchased to be sold, and that creates a very, very difficult issue for producers. There are unscrupulous people that get involved in this product, as is any sort of new investment scam, and I think they're providing a disservice to the ethical licensed producers that we have in Minnesota. And ultimately, it could jeopardize an agent's ability to advocate for a true life settlement for a needy policyholder. And for insurance companies, it creates a problem because they will be reluctant to write policies for seniors. More importantly, this will adversely affect pricing. The pricing of life insurance policies and mortality tables, as the actuary would probably tell you, and I'll try and do it in 30 seconds or less, is based on the fact that a lot of policies are lapsed. In other words, people no longer continue to pay their insurance premium. The policy is lapsed, and therefore the insurance company takes the premium money without having to pay the death benefit. That formula is calculated into the cost of insurance for everyone. With the STOLI type transactions, you're getting to the point where these policies won't be lapsed. They'll be purchased by someone else who will continue to pay the premiums and then receive the death benefit. And in the long run, I think that will affect the pricing structure for policies, especially policies for seniors. Insurance companies are going to be setting up defenses against STOLI, which means they'll have to wade through a labyrinth of documents that they feel are intended to disguise the intent of the policy. And under current law, they have to do so within a 24-month period. There is a proposal out to extend that period for anything that looks like a STOLI transaction to 5 years instead of 2 years. And the effect of that would be to, I think, inhibit investors seeking to get their money into this particular type of investment, because the longer that you have for that window for the actual beneficiary, the actual person, to receive the life benefits before it's sold, the less opportunity there is to make money. And so we think the five-year period might be an inhibitor. There's a big difference in settling an existing policy compared to entering a transaction that at its core is to set it up to be sold. So I want to make the difference between an existing policy that's settled and one that is being set up to be sold in the future. I think we want to maintain true life settlements, but somewhere we have to draw the line, and I think the legislation before you, which you'll probably address next year, will hopefully address that. And so we want to prevent a small group of financiers from breeding policies that are intended to be sold for investments, that ignore the insurable interest law, that adversely affect policyholders, producers, and life insurance companies. So I would encourage you to support legislation when you have an opportunity to do so, to prohibit this practice. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Spezzetto. We appreciate your comments. Next up, we have Ms. Miller and then Mr. Abrams. If you could both come up, we're going to try to treat this sort of like an on-deck circle at this point, as we try to be cognizant of members' time. So I've got Faye Miller from 21st Century Services, and then Mike Abrams from Smart Think. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and legislators, my name is Faye Miller. I work with 21st Services in Minneapolis. I've had a long time. I was born in Minnesota and raised here. I've a long personal interest in longevity and aging. What woman doesn't? But mine was more academic than anything. I'm a licensed attorney in Minnesota. My CLEs are predominantly in estate planning and elder law. I'm the most senior underwriter at 21st Services in Minneapolis. I've also done work in securities and insurance fraud prior to and while I'm here. And in ERISA, I have an interest in insurance. Basically, what I want to tell you about is what 21st Services is involved in. They're pioneers. They're the largest group that does life expectancy certification. What that is review of medical records. We have developed a computer program that can calculate how long a life is expected to run, and we provide these services to the life settlement industry and are in the process of developing other applications also for estate planning as a helpful tool and certain other areas. Our business is both domestic and global. Basically, we collect and update, et cetera, mortality data. And 1% of our charts that we read are terminal illnesses. 99%+ are seniors. Our business has expanded from what I have seen in the settlement industry. I've been in it since 2002. The company has been a corporation in Minnesota since 1998. We've gone from 5 people, and I was one of those 5, to 55 people within the last several years, last 5 years. We began by doing analyses of, based on medical records of individuals' life expectancy on high-dollar insurance policies. This has, as more consumers are becoming aware of the value that might be added as a utility and the availability of their capacity to sell life insurance policies, we've seen a change in that particular area of the business. The kinds of things that we work with We have developing business in other areas also. Insurance started out to be something that would protect people against the risk of dying too soon. What I have seen, and we have seen at the 21st Services, is that there's also a longevity risk, a risk of people outliving their assets. So we are working on doing a education program, etc., and have retooled some of our reports so that we can also help financial planners do a better job. That's something that I'm involved in at this particular point. We're indirectly and directly affected by positive or negative changes in life settlement. What we would really like to see is that while there may be some difficulties, we don't want to see valid transactions eliminated. This is a booming consumer area, and as people are becoming more interested in this and aware of its capability, there are very positive things that can be had from this. We don't want to see legislation, if legislation will help or hinder. We want the sellers of policies to be able to participate in an open market, but in an informed way, and are supporting fundamental fairness in an open marketplace so that something that's new like this can be made available to people who are interested, who are informed as to what is going on here, and choose to participate in these kinds of transactions.
Thank you, Ms. Miller.
Sorry, I'm so nervous.
Normally, I'm not. Well, and we have, I understand also, it's a
time
pretty
thing.
Complex topic that you try to shrink down into a very small amount of time. But I think we're already developing a pretty good picture, and I know we've got Mr. Abrams here to add a little to that picture. Are you any relation to a fellow we knew named Abrams, by the way?
It depends what side of the aisle and what day of the week.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, if it's all right with you, could I introduce one of our clients and allow him to read a brief statement?
Absolutely.
The committee. This is Carl Wolk. He's a Minneapolis businessman for the last 50 years, and he was one of our clients and participated in a life settlement, and I'd like for him to tell his story.
He looks like he's only like 36 years old, though. How's he been in business for 50 years?
75 this week, next couple weeks. I owned a business here in Minneapolis. I started 44 years ago. And we built that business up from one retail store to 16 stores in many different states. All my life I've worked in the business, and I've never taken anything out of the business. Always worked, put more in, added more, and so on and so forth. In 2003 and 2005, I took out a life insurance policy to protect my family and my company, because everything I had was in the business. I had owned the business for 44 years, and I wanted to protect my investment for my family. In October of 2005, I sold enough shares of my business to a couple of guys who had the controlling interest then of 50.1%. I knew these gentlemen, and I felt I was safe and so on and so forth, and I was going to have a payout in a 5-year period. Through mismanagement, they filed bankruptcy in October of 2007. So everything that I had coming went down the tube. There was nothing left. So after all those years, I had nothing except the life insurance policy. I didn't know much about life insurance. I didn't know much about insurance. I always remember that movie when Woody Allen robbed a bank, and his sentence was to spend the evening in the cell with the life insurance salesman. So that's about what I knew about it.
Mr. Spizzetto, could you return to the table?
But anyway, my agent said to me, he said, you know, I couldn't afford the premiums any longer. They're just outrageous. So he said, don't think about selling your policies. So I asked him what he meant, and then he told me. So I was able to sell my insurance policies. Otherwise, I really would have been destitute. My working years were probably at an end. I was already checking at the Costco as a greeter, which isn't bad. But the funds I received from my policies will enable my wife and I to live a very comfortable life, because I plan on being around for my youngest grandchild's wedding, and she's 2 years old now. Anyway, as a citizen, I understand that this insurance law would have prevented me from selling these policies. I plead with you to not take away this important right that I exercise. Without it, I just don't know what we would have done. So don't pass any bill, please, that would take away senior consumer benefits. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Abrams?
Thank you. Mike, my name is Mike Abrams. I work with Tamar Fink, which is an insurance agency and a financial planning agency, basically catering to senior citizens. The reason why I brought Carl up here to speak is because he is one of those seniors who bought a policy for estate planning purposes, and within a very short period of time, his life took a change. And that change involved, was made palatable by the fact that he could get out of a deal that he got into in the life insurance market. And that is probably where the crux of the conflict comes in between those who favor the option to in a vibrant marketplace to sell life insurance, and those who would like to very much limit the market. It's important to note that even though this is a new market, that both the Minnesota Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court have recognized the right to sell a life insurance policy for in or about 100 years. Okay, so there's nothing new about a senior's right to sell a policy. Okay, what's new is the limitations that are being suggested to put on that. In the past, before this marketplace took hold, a senior like Carl would have had to take his policy and simply surrender it back to the life insurance company, and he would have basically gotten nickels on the dollar. As you go forward with any legislation, be of a mind to know that any time a senior surrenders a life insurance policy, that is an extremely profitable event for the insurance company. When a senior is allowed to sell his policy for a lot more money than the cash surrender value, it becomes a very positive transaction for the senior. So everything that is done, and as we saw with the NAIC bill, that goes from take something from a position where you can sell the policy to a position where you have to hold it for 5 years will drive up the amount of policies that wind up getting surrendered and thus profit the insurance company. So it's something that you have to keep in mind. Now, as the other speaker said, when this started, when the marketplace started to develop, you know, as in all new marketplaces, there are people that take advantage of certain situations, and thus the stranger-originated life insurance started. Now, nobody here, including me, is an advent of fraud. You know, we're not going to advocate for fraud. Basically speaking, it is a practice that has been very much eliminated by the insurance companies already. They have put in different types of standards for underwriting of seniors, which, yes, they are burdensome, but they're never going to go away. Okay? That's just how it is when you're taking out a lot of life insurance on somebody who is 70 years old or older, or 65 years old or older. They want to take a look inside and out at what they're insuring. So we don't have a problem with insurance companies getting aggressive in terms of how they underwrite policies. Now, in terms of prices going up and things to that, there are marketplaces that go up and down all over. We have not really and truly felt an impact on the consumer end of seeing drastic price increases. As a matter of fact, in many cases, because of all the competition for this marketplace, the marketplace is continuing to fluctuate and in many cases go down. The Commissioner of Revenue, who I've met with on a couple times, brings his life experiences to this issue. And I want to address it just a little bit, because his comments are sincere and his anger at what's happened to the mortgage industry is palpable. The truth of the matter is the bills that you've seen before you really and truly don't address the securitization of these of the life insurance industry. It also has to be pointed out that the asset underlying the settlement of a life insurance policy is far different than the asset of a mortgage. There's no depreciation of a life insurance policy. There's only appreciation. As you get closer, the value increases. There's no default risk. There's no interest rates that are going to be reset. Once these things are sold into the marketplace, that there just really is, it's really apples and oranges. The last thing I want to point out to the members is that this is a very, very big deal in this state. Because of banking regulations and other things, this has a lot of tentacles to it. You have a lot of trust organizations that are set up in this state. You have insurance agencies, you have life settlement brokerages, you have actuarial services, and on and on and on. And the back of the envelope type of calculation that we've done is that this industry generates in excess of $50 million a year to the state in terms of tax revenues and other things. So it's not a small little deal. This generates real revenues, provides real jobs within this state, and it's something that I really appreciate the chairman's work in herding this into a situation that nothing got rushed through, that we're going to have a real opportunity to hear this issue. And I'll be happy to take your questions at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Abrams. I think we're going to hold off on the questions because in about 20 seconds, I promised folks that we'd have the testimony done. We still got about half a dozen folks to hear from. But thank you all very much.
Thanks.
We have Mr. Tigler, and then Ms. Roan, Ms. Ferguson, Leslie Chapman, and Rick Clavin. And at the risk of sounding a little bit rude, we've got about 20 minutes left of the committee's time, at which time folks will be wandering out. So out of consideration for the folks that are going to follow each of the testifiers yet to come, if you can try to be as brief as possible and to the point. And thank you and welcome.
Thank you. Good evening. My name is Jeff Tegler. I'm a principal in the life insurance firm Garrity, Tegler, and Varley Wealth Strategies, LLP. I do life settlements as a part of my life insurance business. I want to thank you for slowing this very important legislation down just a little bit. I agree that you need to draw some lines and you need to prevent some abuses. But I'd like to echo what Professor Pender and Dominic said. The line you have to draw is between two very different transactions. The first is stranger-initiated life insurance. That's a transaction where investors initiate the insurance, and there's never any intent to have the policy benefit people with an insurable interest in the insured. The second transaction is a life settlement. That's the sale of a no longer needed life insurance policy for more than the cash value, also to investors. So I would urge us to keep in mind of the two terms he used, stranger originated is, I think, the problem, as opposed to stranger owned, which would also encompass all life settlements. I'm just fearful of unintended consequences from this legislation, and I don't know if these are real or not, but I'd like people to think carefully about these over the next little while. Will the August 1 effective date change the rules on consumers who entered into transactions that were legal at the time they entered into them, at the time the policy was taken out, and fully disclosed to the insurance company, and in some cases promoted by the insurance company? Will the 5-year ban on certain life settlements impact the price Minnesotans can get on all life settlements? If Minnesota does turn out to pass some legislation that's more restrictive than other states, will that make life settlements less available in Minnesota than in other states? And finally, will this impede acceptable estate planning techniques? I agree some lines have to be drawn. Please eliminate schemes to manufacture new policies solely to be sold to strangers. But I'd urge you to be careful. Don't draw the lines in the wrong places. Many policies are not retained until death for very legitimate reasons. And please be careful not to prevent Minnesotans from realizing the full market value for their no longer needed policies. So again, I thank you for being deliberate and taking some time to think carefully about possible unintended consequences in this complex legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Folks, up next, I've got Ms. Rowan, Mr. Ferguson. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you very much. My name is Robin Rowan. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, which is our new life insurance trade association. Minnesota-based life insurers were part of the Insurance Federation of Minnesota until late last fall, and then we broke off and formed our own organization focused life insurance, annuities, long-term care, and other products that provide financial security for Minnesotans. We have about over 18,000 jobs here in this state, and that does not include the agents that distribute our products in every corner of the state. We provide, we're very committed to Minnesota and contribute millions in charitable giving to the state as well. What I think I'm going to do in the interest of time, because you guys can hear me probably more often than you want to, is to cede time to Leslie Chapman, who's a senior actuary with Securian, and then Bruce Ferguson with ACLI, who's settled here from D.C. and has a tremendous amount of experience in this area. And then if there's time left, I'll...
Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Leslie Chapman. I work here in St. Paul at Securian Financial Group. I've worked here for 31 years as an actuary. I'd like to spend a few minutes today in my testimony talking about what the impact of widespread STOLI would have on the price of insurance for seniors. And there is a handout that has some boxes on it that are blue and red. If you find that in your packet, I'll reference it as I speak. Thank you. I'd like to begin by describing briefly how a life insurance company goes through the process of pricing life insurance. But I'm going to boil this down to a minute and a half. How's that?
Yeah.
We look at, and I'm going to use my example of 75-year-old clients, because we are talking about STOLI and we are talking about the impact on seniors. Life insurance is all about the sharing of risk. So the first thing we do is we consider the 75-year-old client, and we look at if he's healthy enough to join in a risk pool with other 75-year-olds. Very important to remember the sharing of risk concept that underlies all of life insurance. Now, we know that some of the 75-year-olds we insure are not as healthy as others. Some are going to have shorter life expectancies. Some are going to have longer life expectancies. And on the diagram that is being handed out to you, if you look at the blue box at the top, that represents the risk pool for a 75-year-old. And you'll notice I've written on one side that we have longer life expectancy people and we have shorter life expectancy people. In the middle, on the bottom, you'll notice I've written that what we do is go through and we determine the average cost for all those 75-year-olds. That's the second most important thing to remember about life insurance. Everybody in that box, everybody in that risk pool pays the same premium. All those 75-year-olds pay the same premium because they're sharing in the risk for each other. Now, we estimate that average cost, and that's the amount of money that's paid in every year by those 75-year-olds. And that's the amount of money that's used to pay off the death benefits when each of them die. So the fundamentals of life insurance, sharing of risk, average cost, everybody pays the same, and that's the money that's used to pay off the death benefits. Now I'd like to focus a little bit on what happens when a significant amount of STOLI is sold to 75-year-olds. And you'll see the second diagram. Mm-hmm. And on that I have a red box. And that red box would represent STOLI sales to 75-year-olds. Now, we know that the target market for STOLI are those seniors that have shorter life expectancies, because this is the marketplace that is most beneficial for the investors that drive the STOLI investment. They don't want their money tied up a real long time, so they want to maximize the return, and they want the death benefit paid out as soon as possible. So this is the reason that the red box is parked way over on the right-hand side, because most generally, these are the seniors that have the shorter life expectancy. And as you can visualize, just a little physics experiment, if you have more weight on one side, it's going to change the balance. And so what we need to do is move that balance point over to the right to shift it, and what that means is the average cost for the whole pool has to increase. And when that average cost increases for the whole pool, all the 75-year-olds end up paying more for life insurance. It's just a fundamental basic based on the way insurance works. The pooling of risk, the sharing of an average cost, and then that's the money that supports the payout for the death benefit. Another way of sort of summarizing that real quickly is to say that the STOLI promoters really look for arbitrage opportunities, opportunities to cherry pick situations where they can pay the lowest average cost that they can find out there in the industry for a less than average health senior, with the goal of maximizing the death benefit payout to the investor. And that's classic arbitrage, and that happens in many markets. We see arbitrage in many, many different markets. But it's very important to remember that someone needs to foot the bill. For every dollar of arbitrage gain, there's a dollar of arbitrage pain. And those who are going to foot the bill are all the other seniors, all those that reside in that blue box. I'd like to touch real quickly on another term you may have heard as you have STOLE discussions, and that is lapses. What are lapses, and why are they important in this discussion about STOLE? When someone decides to leave their policy behind, they lapse it. Their life insurance needs have changed, their family has grown, their financial situation may have changed, there's all sorts of reasons. And one of the statistics you may hear in STOLE discussions is that more than 80% of life insurance policies lapse without any payout of death benefit. And I'd like to clarify that just a bit for you so that you can better understand that. As Securian, our average lapse rate for our individual life policies, which are generally the target for STOLE business, run around 6% a year. That means we start the year with 100 people, we end the year with 94. And now, if you were to take and track those 94 people, and let's say they're all 30 or 40-year-olds, and you track them for 3 or 4 decades, and you get 3 or 4 people dropping off every year, if you did that for 30 or 40 years, by the end of the 40 years, you probably only have about 20 people left in that pool. That's just a fact of life that we live with. People change, and people's needs change, their insurance needs change. The inference that is made by those who promote STOLE is that lapses create a gold mine for the insurance company. I strongly disagree. At Securian, we would be thrilled if our lapse rate was zero across the board. That's what we would like. But we have to live with the fact that some people do decide to drop off and drop their policy. And we know that lapses are going to continue to happen. The other thing we know is lapses don't happen straight across the board. If you look at that, if you look at the blue box, lapses are not happening evenly across for those who are more healthy and those who are less healthy. What tends to happen is those people who don't consider lapsing are those people who know that their health has deteriorated since they bought their insurance. It makes sense. They know their life expectancy is getting shorter, and those are the people on the right-hand side of the blue box. So let's get back to our 75-year-olds and wrap this up. If you turn to the third diagram, we know that the left side of the box shrinks over time just by lapses. This kind of normally happens. And we know that that's shrinking faster than the right-hand side of the blue box. We can take all that into account when we figure out our average cost. That's not an issue. But what we have not taken into account is the idea that the vast majority of all the policies in the red STOLE box are just not going to lapse. The reason is they tend to be those who have the shorter life expectancy, and the owner or the investor is very interested in those policies not lapsing, because the idea is for the policy to stay in force so the death benefit can be paid out, so as to create the rate of return for the investor. This situation, of course, leads to an increase in the cost of insurance for all seniors, much like I just described earlier. So I'd say in summary about lapses, lapses are a fact of life. We're not getting rich off of lapses. As I said, at Securian, we wish they were zero across the board. However, if there is widespread STOLE and it has very low lapse rates, this is just another reason that we believe the cost of life insurance will increase for seniors. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Chapman. We appreciate your comments. Welcome to Minnesota, this wonderful time. Usually, by the way, it's 50 and sunny and beautiful. But
well, it's great to be here, although on my plane this morning we were delayed because of the snowstorm last night. So it's great to be here, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Bruce Ferguson with the American Council of Life Insurers. ACLI's members account for 90% of the life insurance in the United States, as well as here in the great state of Minnesota. I'm just going to make one point. Many of the other points were made very eloquently by the other speakers. The point I'd like to leave you with is that your laws are insufficient to stop STOLE transactions from occurring. The insurable interest laws, as well as the settlement law that you have on the book, are outdated and really need to be updated. And that was the conclusion that was reached almost unanimously by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners and the National Conference of Insurance Legislators when they updated their model laws beginning about 2 years ago. They went about it in different ways, but nonetheless, they both were decided that there needed to be an effective solution to STOLE. If you read the most recent Business Week article, approximately $10 to $20 billion of STOLE transactions have estimated to have occurred since the year 2004. That's a lot of activity, a lot of problems out there that are now manifesting themselves in the form of litigation. There are many types of transactions, but many are designed to evade the concept of insurable interest through the use of trusts and other limited liability corporations and other entities that design to cloak the existence of insurable interest. And that's what we're seeing in litigation in New York, here in Minnesota, and elsewhere, that these schemes are devised by those who lack insurable interest for the sole purpose of initiating a policy that will end up in their hands and not remain with the individual who needs the financial security protection the policy affords. So it's those types of transactions that are not covered by your laws. They need to be covered, otherwise consumers are at risk. The integrity of the life insurance product is at risk, and we'll end up having more and more problems akin to what we're seeing in the subprime market. Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude there in the interest of time, and with respect to the other speakers, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Ferguson. Appreciate your comments. Is there anything further?
I don't know.
Robin Rowe with Misty. Just three quick points based on the homework assignments that we handed out. There's two articles. The first one is from Business Week, and it's about death bonds, and it's about the packaging of life insurance policy and how they become securities. Their insurance tells them, they clean it up a little, they call them longevity derivatives, which is actually kind of funny because it's not about how long you live after once you die sooner. But it's, I think it's a very good way to get an understanding of what's happening in the marketplace. It also talks about some of the abuses. This market has grown incredibly fast. We, like the others that have spoken, feel very strongly that we're not trying to limit the legitimate good faith. As a secondary market for life insurance.
Bring that up.
That was good.
For the we have no, we do not want to limit that argument at all. So Mr. Abrams' client, in our belief, would not be affected by what we want to do. That, in our view, is a good faith, legitimate transaction. Unfortunately, though, speculators have not been content with just going settling policies for people that have had them for a long time. They are actually using the secondary market to go out and promote the purchase of life insurance. And that goes to your second homework assignment, which is Read from Retirement Weekly. You have all summer to read these, or floor sessions. But that talks about all the dangers about free insurance, and that it's not exactly... as you know, something sounds really good, too good to be true, it's probably not. And it highlights a lot of the consumer's concerns and the abuses that have been going on with this silly practice. So I want to thank the committee for their time, and we look forward to working with you over the interim and next session on stopping silly practice.
Thank you, Ms. Rowan. Representative Ellis?
Mr. Chairman, just before Ms. Rowan leaves, I got a little tick there. I heard her say the words good faith. Is any of your bill involved in this discussion here today, Mr. Chairman?
Not yet, but I'm getting interested in it. I like the fact that Mr. Ferguson actually smiled and laughed. He had no idea what we were talking about, but he's so polite.
Seem more and more humane by the moment.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is an issue that is front and center in roughly half the country. State legislatures are taking up this issue in earnest because they recognize the problems to consumers. The gentleman spoke about a real-life situation where they can and should be allowed to settle their policy. Those types of exceptions are specifically allowed in the legislation that was developed by NCOIL and the NAIC, and we certainly have no quarrel with that. It's those contrived transactions initiated by investors for investors that puts us all at risk. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ferguson. But last, I guess I've got two yet on the agenda, Mr. Clavin and Mr. Sabe from Great West. And I know, Mr. Clavin, you can be relatively brief.
I will be very brief. Rick Clavin, I work with Thriving Financial for Lutherans. We're a fraternal benefit society in Minneapolis. And I'm also here on behalf of the Minnesota Fraternal Congress. We're an association of 30 or more fraternals doing business in the state. You may recognize some names, Knights of Columbus, Catholic Gate Association, Degree of Honor. We're membership groups. We have over 560,000 members in the state, and we're about two purposes. One is community service. We have a handout in there that kind of talks about the things we do. Frankly, we don't talk enough about them. But the other thing we do, much like the commercial life insurance companies, is we provide life insurance and other products for financial security to our members. And as such, we are very concerned about the practice of SOLI. Frankly, being a membership group is kind of tricky to get SOLI worked into what we do. You know, speculators, strangers, membership. It has happened, but more than that, we're very concerned about how this will affect the viability of life insurance, some of the tax preferences and other things. We don't really think it's what life insurance is supposed to be about. And with that, I'll end my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Clavin. And finally on the list, I've got Mr. Sabe, Ms. Almeida, that I see your name in conjunction with Mr. Sabe. So welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Christine Almeida, representing GWG Life Settlements, and since the chairman and Mr. Cesetto put us in the business of languages, te voy a hablar un poco hoy muy rápido en español. Members and Mr. Chairman, soy es muy malo. There's no one in this room who is going to get up today and tell you SOLI is a good thing. We should continue to allow this. So let's just make sure we make the distinction between the fraudulent act that is what is called SOLI and the legitimate act of this transaction of life settlement. And with that, I'll turn it over to John Sabe.
Wouldn't happen. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Appreciate the opportunity to address you this evening and for taking the time to learn about life settlements in contemplation of legislation. I'm CEO of GWG Life Settlements. We are a buyer of life insurance policies in the secondary market. I left the Grim Reaper upstairs. I didn't feel it would be appropriate. But the reality is that life settlements are a very pro-consumer, pro-senior invention, financial or otherwise. And it's important that you consider all of the ramifications for putting forth legislation, in particular the powerful industry groups that are attempting to stymie some of the development and innovation that has taken place. GWG Life Settlements is a family-owned Minneapolis-based business. My partner is my brother. We started this business in 2005 as a result of our banking, long-standing banking relationship with WestLB, which is one of Germany's largest financial institutions. We got into this business with them. They wanted to begin to offer life settlements as a opportunity for seniors to sell their policies in the secondary market. They wanted to work with partners who shared their principles and values with respect to transparency, fair market value, and really delivering what is a tremendous opportunity for seniors to sell their policies in the secondary market. In addition, we work closely with Wells Fargo, a very big name as well for Minnesota. They provide the policy servicing, trustee, and custodial aspects with respect to all of the policies that we purchase. We've grown quickly. We are licensed in 23 jurisdictions. We welcome and support legislation and regulatory oversight here in Minnesota as well. In the regulatory parlance, we are a provider. So we buy, we deal with life insurance agents, we deal with the insureds, and we deal with life settlement brokers directly, and we purchase individual contracts of insurance. As an organization to date, we have processed over 2,000 policies for contemplated settlement. We have purchased millions of dollars of life insurance. I was just advised that, in fact, we did purchase Mr. Wolk's policy. And it's important to note as well that Mr. Wolk would not have been able to sell his policy had the five-year prohibition been passed by this body. And so that's really important to look at. We do not promote STOLI. We do not promote investor-initiated, investor-owned life insurance, but we do promote and support a senior's right to be aware of the secondary market and get fair market value for that policy. And I will take Securian's proposal to reduce their lapse rate to zero, and they can just forward any potential policy over to our company for evaluation and settlement. That will save us a lot of money in terms of marketing and making seniors aware of the fact that they do have this right and opportunity to settle the policy. And in fact, if you want to do something innovative, follow London or England, where they now require agents to advise their senior clients of a secondary market policy before they're allowed to lapse. So this is really, I mean, I have to thank STOLI to a certain extent because it has at least brought this to the larger attention of life agents and seniors as to what value a policy may hold. Years ago, they really didn't want to talk about it, and today it's a very, very welcome conversation between an agent and their insured when looking at a value of a policy.
Thank you. We very much appreciate your comments as well as the time and comments of everyone that's joined us this afternoon. I think out of respect for members' time, what I'd like to do, if folks don't mind, the testifiers that came, if you can stick around for a few minutes, if individual members have questions, they're not a shy bunch. And if you can stick around and if members have questions, just find the person who provided the testimony and ask questions of those folks. But to everybody, starting with Professor Pender and onward, I think we got an excellent overview today of an issue that is going to be around for a while, and obviously is a very serious one that I'm glad we took a little bit of time this afternoon to learn more about. And I anticipate that we will come back and hopefully can find some common ground and something that works for as many people as possible when we get back to our next session. And with that, we stand adjourned. Thank you all very much for your time this afternoon.